I have two short readings. The first is from Christy Eby, the lead author of the Intergovernmental Panic on Climate Change report that came out last October. Climate change doesn't drive all of our risks. Our choices determine our risk. And our second reading is from Kate Marvel, who's a climate scientist and a writer. Courage is the resolve to do well without the assurance of a happy ending. So this summer, Ella and I went to Prince William Sound in Alaska, where we took a cruise. In 5 hours, we saw 26 of the sounds over 100 glaciers. And we got to go on a really lucky day because the sun was shining. The tour's ranger kept exclaiming how rare this was. And the sound does get 154 inches of rain every year. And most tours glide through rain or fog or mist. For us, though, the sky was totally blue and the sun glinted on the water. Prince William Sound was more magical than I had imagined. There were straight-capped mountains that came up out of the fjords, trees wove together in a tight, matted forest that looked like fairy tales or Lord of the Rings. We saw at least, I kid you not, 100 sea otters just floating idly on the water, and lots of them had little babies on their bellies. We saw a young humpback whale leap out of the water in what seemed like pure joy. And we saw a fin whale, the second largest animal on Earth, come up for air over and over, blowing out water in what seemed to be a rhythmic dance. The glaciers hung tight to the mountainsides, and the boat came close to the ones that came down to the sea, and it had to steer between chunks of ice that the glaciers were letting off into the water. Up close, the glaciers were both very impressive and not. They were unimaginably thick, and in some places, there was this brilliant ice color. But they were also cracked across the top in a way that reminded me of a scab on a knee that keeps breaking and opening. And they were covered with this dirty, melting summer snow. Still, those glaciers were strong and tenacious, large with might, flowing down the mountainsides as they have for millennia. And how could my heart keep from singing? The ship floated for a while in front of the glaciers, waiting to see if they would calve, sheaving off large chunks of ice into the fjords. We didn't see any calving, but the guide shared how much the glaciers had been calving in the last 10 years, more so in the last 3, shrinking back out of the sea by thousands of feet. So now they were tightly bound to the ground. It was shocking, truly shocking, to see how much they had melted so soon. And this is not in geological time, but in human time. One of the glaciers, scientists know, hasn't been that small in 900 years. After the dangers of climate change recede for me, as I just live my ordinary life, just doing my ordinary things, as but standing on that ship, looking at how far the glaciers had retreated, climate felt, again, like an emergency. That place, which was poetic without words, was in extreme danger. The feeling of emergency intensified a few days later when I was at a party in Anchorage. Two people were talking about the work they did with Native Alaskan villages. One of the villages was planning to move away from the shore. Its utilities were about to be inundated by water. Dozens of villages will have to move, they were saying. And then one of the speakers got incredibly angry. We can't afford to move any more villages, he said. What should be done instead, I asked. And he exploded. People in Washington have to do something. The moment felt pretty hopeless. The current administration is aggressively changing regulations and rules to increase carbon emissions. Recently, in the last couple of weeks, they cut back on regulations that ensure methane is not released from pipes during oil and gas drilling and weakened the Endangered Species Act so more drilling could occur. They announced they wanted to reduce fuel efficiency for cars and energy standards for light bulbs. They are also working to increase gas and oil drilling. Why? We ask in such frustration and so much anger, would someone do this when one of the strongest hurricanes on record just destroyed a whole island? And when the fires of the Amazon are burning more virulently than ever this year? Closer to home, our own state legislature, controlled by supermajorities of Democrats, couldn't even pass a simple carbon cap and trade bill. The forces of greed are exceptionally strong in our country, and this is worthy of rage. But raging to one another, while absolutely justified and completely necessary, does not create the world we want to live in. Lashing out verbally towards people who consistently prioritize profits and growth over a livable planet is satisfying in the moment, but just frustrating in the long run. The earth is warming up, and people are suffering now. We need to do something which isn't exclaiming that Washington should do something. I think we have to hold for a moment just how sad the situation is. We go into the world, and how can our hearts keep from singing? We live in such a beautiful, amazing planet. But the glaciers are really melting, and the sea is really rising, and people are leaving their homes because of rising water and drought. 1 million species are in danger of extinction. Hurricanes are stronger and more intense. Fires in the Amazon are larger and more dangerous than they have ever been. The world of our childhood is gone, and destruction will continue. And this is worth crying out in so much grief. The kind of grief where people fall on their floors, rip their clothes, and cry out, "What has happened? Why didn't we stop it? What went wrong? Why didn't we listen? Why didn't we act?" The man at the party was grieving. We are all grieving. We have lost, and we will lose more. So, what do we do? The changing chaotic climate is so overwhelming. What can be done now, we ask ourselves. Can we do anything that matters? How do we make progress when our national government actively works to increase carbon emissions? So we worry, and we hold our breaths between disasters. We bandy about numbers. If we do this, the Earth warms 1.5 degrees. If we do that, it's 2 degrees or 3 degrees. We worry about what each of these numbers means in terms of devastation to cities, states, and habitats. What will happen to human societies and political structures? We simply don't know. And so we ask ourselves, what can I do? And we feel small. The advice is so fluid and changing. Once it was drive less, get hybrids, get electric cars. Then it was change your light bulbs, and today it's now eat less meat and dairy and waste less food. We live in completely uncertain times, deeply uncertain, where things change. And most of us hate uncertainty. There is so much risk in it. There is so much loss possible. Our imaginations can take over. And in our uncertainty and despair, it's easy to pull back into our comfortable homes, our regular ways of living, put in an air conditioner where we didn't have one before, grieve the fire in the gorge, and wait for its recovery. It's easy to disappear. As Unitarian Universalists, we are a people of faith and values. Anger and apathy is not who we are called to be.
We are called to be our best selves. That is what most of us want to be. We want to be our best selves. We want to be open to loving the world and remembering that we cannot keep from singing, and also to bless it with our love and care because we love it so much. But what does it even mean to be our best selves in these uncertain times? How do we even know how to be and what to do? And we are called to do so much. We must hold back the worst of climate chaos while at the same time building resiliency against the suffering we know will come. In July, the Sunday services team gathered for their annual retreat, and someone asked, "Why do we do this? Why do we gather week in, week out on Sunday mornings? What are we hoping for?" We pondered, but we decided that we come to service to grow ourselves into the people we want to be and the people the world needs. We asked, in these particular times, in these difficult, challenging times, what do each of us need to truly be our full selves? And what is asked of us? We asked, how might we as a congregation partner with the energy of life so we can embrace ourselves and the world as we are right now, with love and with hope? And then we committed our services to help this congregation envision ways of being in these difficult times. We have to learn new ways of being. We need new ways of being and doing because the old ways aren't working. But it's all uncertainty. The Sunday service team didn't have a great answer to that question. We just knew it was the question. I don't have great answers to that question, even though I'll try. We would all just like to move boldly into the future. Instead, it turns out we're groping in the dark, trying not to despair. Uncertainty when the stakes are high feels terrible. But truly, uncertainty is our hope. The future is unknown. Too many variables exist to even guess at how it might turn out. We simply don't know. We know the crisis, the climate crisis, is happening, but the truth is that the intensity of the crisis is in our hands. The Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change report that came out last year laid out the risks and the dangers, absolutely, but they also offered real scenarios for going forward so there would be less harm. Christy Eby, who was one of the lead authors on the report, said, "Climate change doesn't drive all of our risks. Our choices determine the risk, and those are the choices we are making now." People have the power to reduce carbon now. We have the technology. We have the power to decrease the suffering caused by climate disasters by building climate resilience. We have the social and relational tools to do this. We get to choose how to use that power. Here, in this congregation, we are a gathering of people who truly want to be the best people we can. But what do we need right now? What do our hearts and souls need? And what is asked of us? And what I believe is, we need each other. We need companionship. We need joy. We need to remember what makes our hearts sing, what this planet is that we love. And we need solidarity. What is asked of us is to move from I to we. The entire world has to move from I to we. American culture teaches us to be I's. What can I do, we ask ourselves? What will my action be? But the eyes can't change our situation. We must live in we. We are learning that our food choices drive carbon emissions. However, it doesn't really matter if an individual gives up beef and dairy. What matters is if large aggregates of people give up beef and dairy. We need a movement. We can't ensure forward-looking people fill legislatures and Congress by casting our vote. We need lots of people to cast such votes. We need a movement. We can't build resilience in our communities unless we know other people. We know our neighbors. We need communities coming together and listening to each other and helping each other. We need movements. And congregations are uniquely suited to model the move from I to we. We believe in community. We believe in something greater than ourselves. We can teach ourselves how to listen well to others. We can learn to change our minds, to support each other, to collaborate and cooperate. We can learn with one another, encourage one another. Change is going to happen when I's become we's. Young people know that. They are rising up in protest across the world. In the U.S., they call themselves the Sunrise Movement, and their goal is to create a broad-based national movement to take significant action now. Their goal is to elect people who will do something by creating a regulatory and policy environment where the transition to fossil fuel-free economy is possible. This Friday, they are calling a worldwide climate strike and asking young people to leave school and older people to leave their jobs in a moment that will highlight the extreme emergency of this moment. In Portland, the climate strike will be downtown, and I will be there, and I would like to invite each and every one of you to join me. This is an example of we. President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement. However, half the states in the U.S. signed on to reduce their emissions to meet the Paris Agreements anyway. Oregon is one of them. This is we. Dozens of cities across the world have pledged to reduce their emissions by 80 to 100% by 2050. Portland is one of them and has reduced emissions by 21% since 1990. This is we. There are uncountable projects of people organizing to make all sorts of changes, to reduce carbon, to bury it in the ground, to plant trees, and create local communities and economies that can be resilient in crisis. This is we. In this congregation, one of the ways we learn the power of we is in small groups. We connect and bond in small groups. We build relationships. We can discover possibilities that never came up for the eye. We can become people who love and heal the world together. We have lots of small groups in this congregation, Buddhist, humanist, women's, young families, and writers, just to name a few. You can learn all about the possibilities of these kinds of small groups at the bottom of your e-blast every week. We also have two specific kinds of small groups crafted to really create the move from I to we. The first is Chalice Circles. This has been Wolf's small group ministry program for the last 2 years. In these circles, people come together and listen and share deeper reflections of ultimate meaning based on our monthly themes. You get a chance to share what makes you sing and also what breaks your heart. And people get to know each other, support each other, and learn to speak about what really matters. This year, in addition, we are piloting another kind of small group called Hearth Circles. These are for activists and those considering activism. They will be organized around issues, climate change, racial justice, immigrant justice, and gender and sexuality justice. In Hearth Circles, participants will discover hope and healing through personal reflection, while working on actions within the congregation or the world. Participants will not be alone. Small groups help shift us from I to we, but it also helps us remember joy,
and helps us remember we're together, and helps us remember to keep singing. So you can sign up today after church, after the service, downstairs for chalice circles or hearth circles. So, it may seem like a really large leap to go from melting glaciers to small groups. You might be asking, is she serious? What about electric cars, light bulbs, and reducing beef consumption? And sure, I really think we should all lower our carbon footprints. This is a necessity. The culture needs to start creating society systems so that we all need to do that. But taking all those actions this week isn't going to solve the emergency that we are in. It is beyond that. It doesn't lower carbon emissions at the rate we need. Lowering our carbon footprint also doesn't create climate resilience. Building communities does that. What does do the work that we need done is movements and grassroots communities coming together in loving and powerful ways to change systems. We need to learn and model how to be community together in loving and powerful ways. That's what we need to learn to do. And that doesn't just happen on its own. It happens when we build relationships one at a time. It happens in small groups, in this congregation, and in the ones we learn to create outside of this congregation. It's building people power slowly, one relationship, groups of relationships at a time. We truly, absolutely need each other. We need each other more than we ever have before. Amen. And I have to say, that's actually what I was trying to say, that in this great turning, we should try to lead in love. So all those words I said, that's what I was really trying to say. And we have some time for questions, discussions, comments.
Thank you very much. This is a very wise sermon this morning. I was thinking that I, for whatever reason, watched all of the Democratic primary debates.
Oh, my goodness.
And I didn't hear anything from any of those people like what you just said. I don't think they touched climate change. There was a lot of arguing and putting each other down and all of that. I'd be your manager if you want to run for president.
We have a theme song. I think what has to happen is the pressure from people has to get so strong that it overcomes the pressure on them from the people who fund them, who are oil and fuel companies and people who really get a lot from our fuel economy. It has to hurt. It has to hurt politically. And then they'll start shifting, but not until then, because the power is so great on the other side. I mean, the Democrats decided not to have a climate change debate, and then CNN did. I mean, it's horrifying. But the people do end up having the power. But we have to believe that. But it is strong on the other side. I don't think we can debate that. That's just the truth.
Friday, what time and where?
It's at 10:30, and it's in Terry. Does someone know?
City Hall.
City Hall. And it's, they're going to go across Hawthorne Bridge, and then there's going to be like a fair on the other side. The interfaith service starts at 10. I'm going to go to that. So I'll be there at the interfaith service
at 10.
And
there's going to be flyers at the social justice table downstairs. There's flyers for the climate strike so that you can have all that information on a little piece of paper. Hi, I'm Felicity. And I guess I'm just going to plug myself here. I'm one of the co-leaders along with Martin Burka of the Climate Justice Heart Circle that's starting. And I just wanted to thank Reverend Tracy a lot for that and say two things that I've been saying to people a lot recently. One of them is there are three kinds of climate change deniers. There are people who believe that climate change isn't happening. There are people who believe that humans didn't cause it. And there are people who believe that we cannot change it. And the third kind is the kind that is most common on the left. They believe that there's nothing we can do now, and so they have no responsibility to do anything anymore. Some of them even get to put op-eds about it in the New Yorker with bad...
I was going to say, that was a lovely op-ed in the New Yorker.
With bad science. Because they just have a gut feeling that they don't have to adjust their lives at all. Thank you so much, famous Pulitzer Prize-winning white men. But that is not true. We got here ourselves, and we can help ourselves. A friend of mine who's an ecological designer likes to say, we can heal the climate in our lifetime. And I just like to say those words because they make me feel so much better. We can heal the climate in our lifetime. So if you want to get together with me and Martin and the rest of us and figure out how to do that, put our hands in the soil, make things grow, get more carbon in life instead of in the atmosphere, then sign up for the Climate Justice Heart Circle. So thank you very much, and thank you so much, Reverend Tracy, for this message of hope.
So one of the things I wanted to say about the Heart Circles is there's really going to be time in those circles to talk about how we're feeling and process kind of how our connection is with doing this kind of work. So it's going to have kind of a spiritual depth dimension as well as an action dimension. And I think a lot of that we need that in our hearts. The issues that we're taking on, immigration, climate justice, racial justice, gender and sexuality justice, are all things that are entrenched and really difficult. And so we're going to have feelings about that. And action without sort of processing and finding our hope can really burn you out. It can make you not there for the long run, which is what we need at this point. Yeah, John? Oh, no. Oh, we got a mic back here. Sorry, everybody.
I wish I had questions, but I actually have a couple of comments, and they're kind of sorrows. One of the 20 presidential candidates was a governor here from the Pacific Northwest, Jay Inslee, and his total focus was on climate change. Unfortunately, he's not running at this time. He's running for governor again. And during your talk, which is wonderful, I looked up when Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth came out, and that was 2006. So I guess my question would be, what's happened since then? Why haven't we moved? And has it been the corporate effort? Has it been the fossil fuel companies? Anyway, I just thought I'd start that little discussion.
So I think there has been movement. The renewable energy, the technology for renewable energies is now a really significant factor. We can really use those. And at the time, I think when Al Gore first came out, we didn't really have, that technology wasn't good enough to really take over the load of energy that we want to use. I mean, we have to use less energy too, but it didn't really exist. So I think that there is that. So that's what I know. I'm not an expert. But I think things have changed, but not politically. They haven't changed. That's right.
Thank you, Reverend, for a very good presentation. It was the enlightened youth of our country and of the world that requested us, and when I say us, I mean the adults, requested us to join them in the event for September 20th. In the UU community, I'm part of the UU cluster. You know, there's about 9 congregations in the metro area. And the message that we sent out for September 20th is to congregate on the steps of the Elliott Chapel in the UU downtown, in the First Communitarian Church, at 9:30 a.m. And we would march to Terry Shrunk Park, where we would have a service of combined faith. So many faiths will combine in Terry Shrunk Park at 10. And then at 10:30, we would march across the Hawthorne Bridge to OMSI. So that's the sequence in the events.
Thank you, Don.
John Riles. The person who just spoke, Don Merrick, several years ago, and our congregation led an effort to become a green sanctuary. And that is an ongoing commitment that we should be renewing. And I personally feel like it's time to have an effort, possibly going out of the hearth circles or a group that takes on the mantle of renewing our commitment. It can be a real energizing experience for the whole congregation.
Thank you.
Arriving just a little bit late and finding parking was a terrible problem, and I'm thinking the board needs to take this up. but it involves all of us, and I think this seems like a good time to say, you know, can we develop a carpool situation?
We've talked about developing a carpool system. We just need like three or four people who would just take that on and make that happen. There's other reasons we need carpooling. We need carpooling for our parking lot. We need carpooling for the planet. And we need carpooling for those among us who do not have cars or do not drive, which is our young adults and often our elderly. So it's a hospitality move. It's a planet move. It means we can get everybody in here on Sunday morning move. So if there are some people who have the energy, we have some ideas about how to do it even. We just need somebody with some time. And so come see me.
John Ryleskin and Sue and congregation, I'd like to point out that the board has addressed this topic, and one of the efforts that we're looking at is to providing additional off-street parking directly in the direction that we are looking right now. We have the opportunity to provide access from off-street parking to our premises here, so we can expand off-street parking as well. When I drove by the nearby streets here this morning, there weren't any cars from our congregation on those streets. So we can think about where we park in that regard.
Let us be hope for each other. Let us have courage to believe in a new day.